Hi, Josh.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Josh.
Hey,
I made
Corinne.
you a presenter as well as Mark, so either one of you can drive.
All right, I see that at the top it says that. Make sure.
If you'd like to do it, I'll go ahead and stop sharing now and let you take over.
Or are you sharing?
I was.
Oh.
No longer.
Yeah, I'll practice real quick. Everyone see, you see that now?
Perfect.
All right. I should take it down because, yeah. Okay. Very good.
Hey Josh.
Hi, Chris.
So we just tested the screen sharing. Okay. And I want to apologize to you guys about the confusion about the email that was sent on Monday and we didn't respond.
Broadcasting.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Wednesday, February 24th. There's one item on our agenda, and before I do that, two pieces of business. First, I would very much like to welcome members of the Senate Committee who are joining us, the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. Glad to have you with us as guests this afternoon. Would someone please call the roll for the House Committee on Revenue?
Representative Hernandez.
Absent.
Representative Levy.
Here by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh here by video.
Representative Smith.
We did have an email. Previously, that this falls within a range of dates that the representative would be gone. So let's say excused.
Vice Chair Pham.
Sam is here by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Present by video. Okay, everything's in order. And a reminder, and a notice for anyone who's watching this. Committee members generally keep their video on, but the mic off when we're not speaking. Generally, we try to do that, and it's going to help whoever the presenter is by avoiding, we hope, avoiding any extraneous noise. So, Mr. Allenack, it's over to you. I'm opening this informational meeting.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So today is what we refer to as the March forecast release for the economic and revenue forecast. And as is always the case, we have Mark McMullen and Josh Lehner from the Office of Economic Analysis. So I'll just turn it over to them. I believe Josh is going to share his screen to walk through the slides.
All right, thank you, Chair Nathanson, Chair Burdick, members of the committees. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen. I serve as the Oregon State Economist, and I'm joined, as always, by my colleague, Josh Lehner. So, as with everything else this year, revenue forecasting has been, a unique challenge. And you don't have to squint to see, the severe economic pain that's out there, right? You have countless businesses that have had their lifelines and income cut off by the pandemic. And at this point in time, we have 160,000 Oregonians who have lost their jobs. And so there's obviously a lot of pain, but nevertheless, we have been consistently increasing our revenue outlook, and it's become even more optimistic in the last 3 months. So we know the economic damage and the shock has been extreme, but despite the extreme, job losses and labor market shock, quite surprisingly, the income or overall income in Oregon is not down. In fact, it's up, and it's up very sharply. And so given the fact that we are an income tax state, that has brought our revenues along and our tax collections along with it. So where we are right now, after heading into the pandemic and seeing the job losses, we went ahead and put a $2 billion reduction in the revenue outlook at that time about a year ago. And since then, we've just seen more and more positive signs. And at this point, as of this March forecast, we're now going to be a little bit above where we were prior to the pandemic. So even more revenue than was expected before the recession went underway. And so just to tease what's going on in the future, there are a lot of factors behind this, but two of them really stand out. One being this massive helicopter drop of an unprecedented amount of federal aid that has supported our local state revenue instruments. And the second being the surprising performance, or maybe not to everyone, but we've had very healthy and stable investment income and business income. Where in many recessions we see these, and particularly the last two, we've seen these massive declines in business income and massive declines in investment income, which served to reduce revenues. This time around, that shoe has yet to drop. Another reason that our forecast for revenues continues to get stronger and stronger, a third one would be the underlying economic outlook itself is becoming more and more positive. In meeting with our advisors and talking to other economists in other states, we're at a point right now where we really have a very solid foundation for the next couple of years, or at least the next year, where the stage is set for not just growth, but very rapid rates of growth. And this is coming out of three main sources. One being, again, we're expecting another fiscal aid package to work its way through the federal Congress, almost the size of the CARES Act that came before it. Important reason, though, of course, is the virus itself, where we're seeing the infection numbers go down and the rollout of the vaccines progressing. And if that continues without any new variants popping up or the like, that would be the main conduit for a return to normalcy, which will bring with it quite a bit of job growth. And finally, the last big reason is the fact that many Oregonians, those who have not lost their jobs, are saving a lot more than they have in the past. So on aggregate, we've seen savings rates go up quite sharply. A lot of this has to do with people not being able to spend like they normally do, not to be able to do the same activities they normally would, can't go on vacation and the like. And so this is sitting in checking and savings accounts and should provide some tinder for future economic growth. So with that, we will start with the economic outlook, and I'm gonna pass it along to Josh to go into a little bit more detail about those drivers.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner with the Office of Economic Analysis. And given this is a global pandemic and was the catalyst for everything that has occurred in the last 12 months, we'll start there, talking about the encouraging progress we're seeing in terms of COVID right now, right? Where we're seeing the number of new cases and the number of hospitalizations is down by about two-thirds in the last couple of months. It's been very encouraging. Of course, we're still just back down to where we were in the summer when of course, people felt like it was taking it much more seriously than maybe some folks are doing today as pandemic fatigue has set in. But again, given where we were around the last time we met and we started to put in more restrictive health measures because we saw that third wave really ramping up last fall, we've seen tremendous progress. In the vaccine rollout, we're now up to around 16% of the adults in Oregon have at least one dose of the vaccine, and that number will continue to increase, and hopefully we'll reach some level of herd immunity later this year where we'll actually have a large enough share of the population choose to receive the vaccine. And this increase, the decrease in the pandemic will result in a big increase in consumer spending as long as people feel safe, or at least safe enough in their ability to go out and resume activities that they really haven't done in the last six to 12 months. As Mark was saying, from an economic front, this cycle is different. It's a very severe economic shock in terms of the job losses. We're still about 9% down, 160,000 jobs, yet incomes are 4 or 5% up in aggregate. And that has to do with federal aid. You can see the first big spike in the red line. That was the CARES Act, the one-time recovery rebates, the expanded unemployment insurance benefits, and the like. And those have gone away in the last, 6 to 9 months after that package was passed almost a year ago. We still have incomes overall that are larger than they were prior to the onset of the pandemic. We have another aid package built in to our forecast. That's that second spike in the dotted line, where we're going to see another round of that, where, in fact, the one-time recovery rebates are going to be even larger at $1,400 a person to get to that $2,000 per person when you combine with the December aid package that Congress passed. And then the expanded unemployment insurance benefits will be there in as well, although at a reduced level. And that'll be less of a key driver in the macroeconomic sense because the economy is getting better. So there'll be fewer people claiming unemployment insurance benefits. And then it'll be at $300 or $400 a week instead of the $600 a week we saw a year ago. But all told, that is keeping incomes up, and incomes up, this far into a recession in the recovery that we haven't seen before. We haven't seen this in decades, this level of income support coming from the federal government. Encouragingly, if we were to take out all of the direct aid, just mathematically take out the rebates, the unemployment insurance benefits, the Paycheck Protection Program income, that underlying economic income in the state of Oregon is all the way back to where it was before the pandemic. So the economy has proved much more resilient than first feared as well. Of course, some of that resiliency is due to the implications or the impacts of that federal aid, but mathematically, underlying growth has returned pretty well within the past year, all things considered.
Now, Mr. Lehner, we have a question. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Lehner, thanks for this information. I just had a couple of questions about incomes being up and how that's calculated. Is that based on number of people employed and is that the total income of all Oregonians divided by those employed? I'm just curious how that is calculated. And then also my second question would be about the 160,000 people that have lost their jobs. Has that been primarily in the private sector or the public sector or a mix?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, this is total income across all sources. So wages tend to be 60 to 70% of income earned. Then you have rental income, interest income, small business income and the like, right? So it's aggregate, all of that added together across the entire population is up. Now it's up because of that federal aid. Absent the federal aid, it's basically flat. In terms of the job losses, it's relatively proportionate between the public sector and the private sector. Now, of course, the vast majority of the losses are in the private sector because the private sector is so much larger. But they're roughly down about the same because local education jobs are down tremendously. And if you dig into it, that's primarily substitute teachers. It's not that full-time staff in local education or at the universities have been laid off disproportionately. It's that we're not using substitute teachers with distance learning, or that's roughly down 70% because you can put a video on, or in one of my children's cases, the principal subbed in for the day when the teacher was out. So you can make things work a little easier on that front. And then at the universities, student workers are down, dorm workers are down, rec center workers are down. But overall, the percentage declines are roughly the same. In the private sector, it more than half of the job losses are concentrated in the restricted service sectors. So you're talking leisure and hospitality, other services, which is a lot of barbershops and nail salons and the like, and then some healthcare is down as well. That's at least 50 to 60% of the private sector losses are just right there in those industries.
Thank you.
And I'm going to add a question of my own. I find it really interesting that when you take out federal stimulus money or expanded unemployment insurance, for example, that rather than our baseline economy being down, it's flat. We know that so many businesses, particularly small businesses, are struggling or closed entirely right now. Does that mean that there's a sort of a significant area of the economy that is larger than it would have been a year ago this time?
Chair Nathanson, absolutely. We've seen large increases in consumer spending in physical goods. Things you can buy online, home improvement stores, homes and car sales as well. So all those jobs associated with e-commerce more broadly, so warehousing, trucking, and the like, are at historic highs right now. And so the consumers are spending as much money as they really can, given they can't go out to eat in as much as they used to. They can't do happy hours. They can't do long distance travel, being on airplanes and the like. But they've shifted that spending in the physical goods and the stuff you can kind of order online. And so all of those types of sectors of the economy are doing quite well right now, whereas our service industries are suffering quite a bit, and their employment is still down 15-20% today. And I'll go on talking about that. That shift in the consumer spending is something that is really important to understand for why we think growth in the second half of this year and into next year is going to be so strong. It's because we're buying basically as much as we can online. We've signed up for additional streaming services to entertain ourselves as we spend more time at home. You know, sales of board games are through the roof, all this sort of stuff. You know, we're spending a lot of money, but we're still not spending as much money as we normally would because going out to eat and on vacations. And some of us, you know, have missed routine dental appointment because it's not an emergency. But some of these types of consumer spending that are restricted either outright due to policies or because of the pandemic and being scared and fearful of doing some of these things. But we've accumulated a tremendous amount of household savings around the country, magnitude of a couple trillion dollars. Talking with some of our advisors that work for financial institutions here in Oregon, they're saying deposits, you know, just retail deposits into their banks or their financial institutions and credit unions are up 20 or 30% in the last year. So this big increase in household savings is very much happening here in Oregon, and it's very liquid. Mark mentioned earlier checking and savings accounts. That's basically what it's doing. Most of it is doing is not being invested yet in the stock market or in GameStop or anything like that. Some is. But most of it's just sitting there in the bank accounts ready to be spent when the time comes and people feel safe enough and confident enough to do so. Now, this is almost all entirely concentrated in middle and high income households. That is where this excess savings has accumulated. Lower income households have gone through good times and bad times in the last year in terms of that federal aid. When it comes in, they're able to pay their bills, they're able to build up a little bit of savings. But as that federal aid has lapsed a couple of times in the past year, then they draw down on that savings and they're continuing to struggle and meet bills by the end of the year. Utility account delinquencies were starting to rise again. The numbers saying they were worried about paying their rent or evictions and the like had started to creep back up again as it had been months without some of that assistance. And that assistance is vital to their economic well-being because their job prospects remain dim until the pandemic's over, right? You can't get a job at a restaurant or a bar today, or they're not nearly as plentiful as they were because consumer spending is down. Once that consumer spending comes back up, then those job opportunities will return. And this pent-up demand that's being expected to be unleashed in, you know, the next 6-9 months is going to be very pro-jobs, right? That shift out of those physical goods and that e-commerce back into bars and restaurants, haircuts and vacations and travel and all that sort of stuff is going to drive millions of job increases at the U.S. level, tens of thousands of jobs here in Oregon. And so we're expecting very rapid growth in jobs just due to this shift in spending. And then, of course, the spending will accelerate, too, because Mark used the word tender earlier, right? There's a lot of financial tender to support this. This won't be deficit financed or household debt related, the money is literally sitting in checking and banking accounts across the state.
I'm going to give you a minute to catch your breath. We have a question first from Senator Findley.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I appreciate that. Mr. Lehner, back on slide three, when you talked about the incomes are up and stable, you mentioned rental income. I remember two forecasts back from the Governor's Council on Economic Advisors. They put the rental income hole of rent not paid at about $350 million by the end of 2020. How does that play in, or is that number been mitigated somewhat by the emergency board's action with the program set to help renters, landlords, and the balance of the whole for the rest of the forgiveness period? Has that factored in at all?
Chair Nathanson, Senator Findley, ultimately that is embedded in these numbers. We don't have as direct of accounting of that sort of thing in these financial accounts that are coming from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, but nationally rental income is basically flat, probably in large part due to some of these issues that you're referencing. Now, I will say that those numbers that are thrown about in terms of the size of the need for rental assistance, those don't come from our office. Some of those are coming from some think tanks or some advocacy groups and the like that are doing their best trying to make sense and gauge how much of a need is out there. But that's a really hard thing to put a number on. But of course, the set aside money that the legislature has done does fill in some of those gaps.
Okay, a quick follow up, Chair Nathanson.
Sure.
So also in your income streams that you're referring to, does that include the federal stimulus checks, both round one and round two, in those numbers? And then I assume in your continued dotted line, the alleged round three that may be coming.
Chair Nathanson, Senator Findley, exactly, right? The first spike is almost, is largely the $1,200 per person, $500 per kid. The $600 per person actually hasn't hit the official data stream yet, but we know that's coming. And then we have assumed a third major federal aid package that will be the $1,400 per person, which is that extra large spike there in the forecast.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Certainly. Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Senator Findley, you stole part of my questions. So I do have another question, though, because I'm going back to the 160,000 jobless Oregonians. And can you go a slide forward? I believe it was four, where you're talking about U.S. checkable deposits. So, and you've already said that that's the upper income people. And since we have so many restaurants and businesses that are closed, and quite a few of those jobless people are in that industry that is not open. And how do we, with their CARES Act funds and that kind of stuff, and when the $1,400 anticipated money comes again, and we have people starting to go back to work, where does that figure in how we're going to, you're saying that once those people start going back to work, those checkable deposits will then be being spent on the economy, is what you're saying. But how does that help the restaurants and that stuff that don't open? I mean, if we don't have the businesses that never open again, that's the word I'm trying to find. If we don't have those in the economy, then how does that help our economy spending-wise? Because if we spend outside of the state on items that we do through mail order and that kind of stuff, we don't see that in our economy.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Levy, absolutely. And if I may, I'm going to go on to the next slide. Because what we're really worried about is this issue I think you're getting at, the issue of economic scarring, of business closures, permanent layoffs, long-term unemployment. And if we don't have those options or those businesses in our communities, you're right. If as the economy reopens, it's safe to go on vacations again, more of that money will maybe be spent, you know, on trips to California or Vegas or whatever the case may be. And right now it's a hard thing to get a handle on. We know businesses are struggling. We know there's been an increase in closures, but putting a hard number on that's really challenging. There's some, you know, kind of miscellaneous third-party data sources out there that are saying, you know, 30% of small businesses in Oregon are closed. You know, apocalyptic numbers like that, which are really challenging to believe the pain. Not that there's not that many businesses struggling, but that many that have closed is a really hard number to swallow, because we're getting real-time data from bars and restaurants in the form of OLCC liquor license renewals and then video lottery retailers that are open, have their doors open and are reporting revenue and the like. And those indicate we've lost about 5%, right? The total number of liquor licenses that are active in Oregon for on-premise sales. So it's a combination of brew pubs, bars and restaurants that have a liquor license. You know, it's down about 5% February of last year to February of this year. The number of video lottery retailers is down about 6%. And lottery has done some research on that shows some of those 6% that aren't open are choosing to keep their doors closed due to the pandemic and the uncertain state of the economy. So they haven't officially shuttered entirely, or at least not yet. And so we know those closures are there. We know those closures are happening. But the numbers are, you know, at 5%, while not, you know, good news. That's a substantial increase in closures. It's not apocalyptic yet, and we're relatively encouraged that this amount of economic scarring, at least so far, there's more still to come as the economy continues to remain bad for some of these categories. But this amount of economic scarring has been relatively limited, if you will, relative to our expectations a year ago or 9 months ago. We were really, really concerned that we would see 20% of businesses closed. And so far, we're not seeing those types of numbers yet. Of course, some are still limping along. Things like the Paycheck Protection Program were able to provide a short-term Band-Aid so that they could limp along for a couple of months. But you know, it's still going to be a while until everybody feels safe enough to resume some of these activities and we see stronger consumer spending in our bars, in our restaurants, in our hotels, and the like over the summer and certainly into the fall. But it's something that's first and foremost from the economic issues is the amount of closures. And then on the unemployment side, the long-term unemployment is really worrisome because it took, you know, the better part of a decade, it took 7 years to get long-term unemployment back down to where it was prior to the Great Recession. And so we've seen this start to increase. We're now almost a year into the pandemic-induced recession. And those long-term unemployed numbers are creeping back up. We're around 60,000 long-term unemployed. The concern here is that once you lose your connections to the economy, once you drop out of the labor force or maybe the hiring manager that said, yeah, you're laid off, but when the pandemic's over, we'll bring you back on. Well, if that hiring manager changes over in the ensuing year after the pandemic starts, then you've lost some of those connections and it might be harder to get back into the workforce. So it's something, you know, these are the things that are front of our minds in terms of risk to the outlook, because the more these become problems, slower the recovery will be as new firms have to replace the old ones in the economy. And then workers have to seek out new job opportunities at firms that they don't know anything about, or they have to, you know, go through the hiring process and get some of these jobs. So we're very worried about it. I think so far we're encouraged with where these current things land, but there's still some more pain to come, I think.
Chair Nathanson, a follow-up comment?
Sure.
I would just say, and I really appreciate it, the information, but I would just say that in rural Oregon, and we have a vast amount of rural Oregon, not just where I live, in rural Oregon, I would say that you're not going to see that recovery as fast as you would hope to see it. And we're probably going to be hit the hardest by it. And that's just an observant, you know, driving around looking at my district at the businesses that are still closed, and some of them do not plan on opening because they cannot afford to do it, and they're going to have to sell things off to pay their debt away.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Levy, I think you can see the future, Representative Levy, because now you're talking, I believe, about the next slide, or if not one just past it, which is, and I'll go ahead and take over on this one. And you're absolutely right that in the typical recession, and granted, this one has been, this sudden stop of economic activity was completely different than what we've seen before. And a lot of this scarring that Josh was talking about is going to take a while to become evident, because it always does. We just haven't given it enough time yet. But one thing that's different so far is that for once, so far, our rural counties have outperformed our bigger population centers in the state. This is so far. And so the way you read this chart as we're coming from the left is at 0%, we're just going into the recession. And at that point, we're at this peak of employment. And then the shock hit, and pretty much everywhere across the state lost about 14% of their jobs immediately. But coming out of this so far, the rural counties have done a little bit better. As you see, they're at this point, our rural counties are down about 6 or 7% on their jobs, versus our biggest population center, Portland, being down still 11%. So this, your understanding is completely right in terms of history. Historically, our rural areas have really struggled during recessions for a couple reasons. One being they don't have as diverse economic bases, and the second being this traditional connection to resource and agricultural firms and the like, which are really boom bust by their nature and go through these sectoral changes in these past big painful recessions. At this time, a couple of things are going on. On the positive side for rural areas, like you say, every place is losing a lot of restaurants and bars. And so it's hard to differentiate, particularly, if you're in a rural area and you lose an anchor, it could destroy it. If you're in Baker City and you lose the Barley Browns downtown or something like that, makes a big difference compared to one restaurant in Portland. So that aside, though, there's a more local and tourism demand in rural areas, particularly the coast and central Oregon, rather than business travel and the like. And so the restaurants have done a little better. Where the restaurants are really getting hammered, or are more so, they're getting hammered everywhere again. But boy, in our urban centers, it's ugly. And part of it has to do with business travel, which has gone away entirely. We see from our lodging taxes, the coast is doing fine and the like, but, downtown Portland and the new convention center hotel and the like, there's nothing there. And a related issue is downtown, right? In big urban areas, we have a big commuter base. Traditionally, people drive into the center of city, and when they're there, what do? They buy lunch, they get coffee, pick up an anniversary present on their way home or the like, and it creates all this downtown energy, whereas rural areas don't, depend as much on a commuter base. And so this lack of going into the office has been less painful. But again, that said, being down 7% in jobs is not a pleasant experience. And, there's clearly enough pain to go around everywhere. But this is unique, given that typically, our urban economies are the first to bounce back. Last time, Portland had a nice V-shaped recovery, but it took our rural areas several years before they started bringing back any jobs whatsoever. So with that, one issue that people are going to bring up when they see, well, Portland's at the bottom of the list here, and it probably doesn't, escape anyone, the big black eye that the metropolitan area has right now in terms of this, endless stream of bad press in the national media surrounding the protests and like in downtown Portland. And so the question would be, is that why we're not getting the jobs back? And that is a long-term concern. Probably here, like I say, it has more to do with the industrial structure, the lack of commuting, the lack of business travel. But more broadly, obviously this black eye is a huge threat to Portland and broader Oregon, because that's our our traditional comparative advantage, and it's going to be more important than ever going forward, is the migration trends. When jobs are available here, we bring them in. And, you know, with very, very young, skilled workers in their root-setting years, you know, that's the gold standard for economic development. And so, obviously, the current, you know, the huge concern here would be, well, what if that's no longer the case? What if Portland loses its attractiveness, which could potentially happen. Some of our advisors are more concerned about it than others, insofar as traditionally, you know, the press attention, you know, Portland had years of great press in the New York Times, and I think that was peripheral, marginal in terms of the decision making. When people decide to move, it usually has more to do with the cost of living and amenities and the like, and hopefully, you know, those are still here. And so that's encouraging, but we need it because, as you see here, we're going to be more than ever relying on migration from other states, because if we don't bring residents in, our population growth is not going to grow. You see those dark blue lines, that's the natural rate of population growth, which is just the number of births minus the number of deaths. And in the rural counties, that's flipped years ago in terms of we got to the point where we were having more deaths every year than births. So without being able to bring in migrants, your area doesn't grow. Well, now we're here at the Oregon averages at that point. Got there faster than we expected because birth rates are so low for the millennial population cohort as they're getting into their child-rearing ages. Hopefully they'll get busy at some point, but to date, nothing yet. And so this is a concern, and you see here that 2020 number for our migration is a depressing one. Now, we're holding out on the judgment on that 2020 number until we get the 2020 census. Every 10 years, we get a big anchor of good, solid data to depend on. And as we further get away from that anchor, the more unreliable our estimates are. So we'll get that soon. It's delayed. We should have it already, but we'll get those numbers soon and see what that looks like. But as you see here, we do expect once this impact on jobs, which as you see in the past, always does impact the migration flows. Once that's gone, we're hoping that and expecting this comparative advantage to return.
Lastly, on the economic outlook, when we put it all together, we get a cycle, a business cycle, that looks nothing like we've seen before. Both the severity of the shutdowns overnight, and then on the upside, a fairly fast reopening due to the improvements in the pandemic and the pent-up demand, or at least the ability to spend money when it is safe to do so. And I think a lot of the stage is set for very, very strong growth over the next 12 to 18 months. Fastest economic growth nationally that we've seen in decades, if not generations, is probably on the table as long as the pandemic doesn't rear its head again and we get another wave of shutdowns due to new variants or vaccine rollout issues or something along those lines. Our forecast is calling for basically half of the jobs, the 160,000, right? About half of those are going to come back in the next year, the other half the year after, and we'll return to something resembling a strong economy or full employment in early 2023. This is 6 to 9 months faster than what we've been telling you in the last couple of forecast releases. And this is a full year faster than what we expected in our May forecast of 2020, our first post-COVID forecast we did almost a year ago last May. This is a year faster than that, right? I think the stage is set, and a lot of it has to do with, again, the encouraging pandemic news, and then the federal aid that has been unprecedented has really kept the economy overall afloat. Now, of course, people falling through the cracks. We have issues. We have things we need to overcome, but much less severe than first feared when we saw that crashing tidal wave of initial claims for unemployment insurance benefits last March, April, and May as we were shutting down. Now, the other thing to note about this is we have assumed a full return to in-person schooling in the fall. Now, school districts are doing it today, at least with the younger grades and hybrid models for the older grades, but the full return to in-person schooling has a double boost to the labor market, double boost to the economy. First, in terms of those direct jobs, particularly the substitute teachers coming back, and then bus drivers and student workers and the like. And then there's the indirect impact that we've talked about before with freeing parents' time up so they don't have to simultaneously try and do school or choose between managing online school for their kids and going to a job, they can return to the labor force in greater numbers or increase their hours worked. And that will provide a double positive, a double boost to the labor market here this fall in a few months. And that should help accelerate the overall trajectory of the economy as well.
Josh, I have one question I'd like to ask, and I don't expect a lengthy answer because we're not even halfway done with the slides yet. But I did want to raise a point. You mentioned about half the jobs coming back in a year, then the year after that, the other half. The jobs may come back, but where people work may not be the same. Some people may have a job or their job hours may be increased, but they may be choosing to work at home, either exclusively or in part. Are economists around the country starting to talk now about the potential long-term economic impact of where employment is? Does it make a big difference? It changes consumption patterns. You mentioned, for example, if people are commuting and they go downtown to work, they're eating downtown. Well, if they're not working downtown anymore, that changes. Maybe they eat at home more, or maybe they eat out in their local neighborhood. So are economists talking about how the way the workplace is changing may shift the economy?
Chair Nathanson, absolutely. There continues to be an ongoing discussion. It's hard to put hard numbers to it yet, as it's still new. But working from home more broadly should be a boost to Oregon. Every part of our state is average or above average from working from home. Even some of our more rural communities are at least at the U.S. average, if not a little above. So we have the scenic beauty, we have the amenities. We have good broadband access. We not that it's great, but relative to most states, we have good rural broadband access. And so the ability to do so working from home, we think will be a boost to Oregon overall. Now, whether where you fall in that city center versus suburb debate, there's a lot of gray area associated with that. And that's where a lot of the ongoing discussion is continue to take place.
Thanks for letting me go down that side path for a minute. We're ready to move on.
All right, then, on to the bottom line, the revenue outlook. So as with everything else, again, a unique recession, and the first chart is meant to exhibit that, where to date, we just have not seen the same kind of revenue losses that we've become accustomed to, at least in very recent recessions in Oregon here, despite, again, the severe shock to the job market. You see here that the blue line, employment growth, is down around 6% over the past year in Oregon, which is the same as the worst year of the Great Recession. But in the worst year of the Great Recession, our income tax revenues fell by 20%. One out of $5, whereas here you see much less. And in fact, if we were to extend this for our preliminary numbers for 2021, the revenues would be back to where they were last year. So, virtually no shock whatsoever here compared to what you might expect. And there are several reasons for this. But again, as an income tax state, that first one that Josh showed, that the incomes are up, well, guess what? That does filter through to our income at this point. But there are two other big things that I really want to focus on. One being the federal aid, which has a massive direct impact. If we add both the direct impact of the, $12 billion in unemployment insurance, along with the indirect impacts of the PPP and the recovery rebate, the PPP money, the payroll protection program, and the recovery rebates, those aren't directly taxable, but nevertheless do have feed-through effects. For the Paycheck Protection Program, in order to get your loans forgiven, you need to spend that money on what? Payrolls or rent or the like. And so those payrolls and rent turn into taxable income for your workers or taxable income for your landlords and the like. And so indirectly, there's a big boost there. And also with the rebates through the federal subtraction. So you add all that stuff together, and we're looking somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, $1.5 billion of Oregon income tax revenue. So I said it, that was, we went into the pandemic, we put a $2 billion hole into the budget. Well, looks like about a $1.5 billion worth of this, again, described as a helicopter drop of aid from the federal government. And that's huge.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I had a question about PPP. I'm just trying to understand the impact of the Paycheck Protection Program, the double tax break that Congress included in their last COVID relief bill. Can you talk about the impact on your revenue forecast from Oregon's connection to the Paycheck Protection Program double tax break?
Sure, Representative Pham, and Chris and his team are going to you know, give this to you until you want to throw up here in a bit. So he'll give you more detail than I will. But we have to coordinate about this because we have a little bit of a chicken and an egg problem, because I need to have an estimate of what the PPP is going to do to revenues in the forecast. And LRO needs to have this forecast and particularly our assumptions about it in order to do their revenue estimate. And so we need to do a little bit of huddling beforehand to make sure we're in the same ballpark on this sort of stuff. And so we think we are in terms of this forecast, and in particular the issue you describe, which is taking deductions for the costs, particularly the payroll again and the rent costs and that you've paid for with federal funds or federal forgivable loans. So the concept is, you know, there is some concern out there that it doesn't seem necessarily right that if you're getting your loan forgiven and then paying folks with that, can you then go and reduce your tax burden by claiming those deductions and the money you spent on the workers and the like? And so that's the concern some folks have. There's a feeling that the other folks have that, well, you know, this was what Congress intended when they passed it, to go ahead and allow these deductions, so you can't take them away. And there was some confusion last year as the IRS put out guidance that said, oh, well, you can't take these deductions. And then at the very end of the year, they said you could. And so what have we done, you know, for this? So we've included, this is a pretty large scale deduction for a lot of businesses. So we've gone ahead and reduced the forecast going forward to account for that, both the waves of PPP taking this away. It's a little bit complicated because not all firms can take all of those losses at once, because if you're not making profits to write off, you can't necessarily take those, so they're going to be spread over time, and some might never be used. But we've gone ahead and spun that through as it is to try, both on the corporate and most of it, 80% of it is going through the personal pass-through entities based on matching that the Department of Revenue has done for us. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but they did a great job of being able to match taxpayer identifiers to these PPP loans for the vast majority of them. And so we have a pretty good idea of, you know, where these are coming from. And again, the vast majority are going to be showing up through the personal tax system rather than the corporate or the C Corp system is where these deductions are going to show up in our forecast.
Follow up, please. Why don't I save it? I'll save it. You said that Chris will be talking more, so I will save my question. I know that we're running late. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Pham.
Yeah, thank you. Chris won't make mistakes like I will. So I appreciate that. I'll misrepresent something for sure the longer I talk. So not a typical recession for tax revenues. The next chart shows the big engine for personal income taxes, which is these withholding out of paychecks. Month after month, we see these personal income tax holdings, mostly paychecks and retirement income that this is coming from. So you would think, again, oh my goodness, well, if this is just paychecks and we've lost, you know, again, the 160,000, we've said this 100 times, but 160,000 workers, that should show up in income tax withholding, but yet it did right away. We saw a dip here right at the beginning of the pandemic, but now we're back up over 5%, which, you know, most states rarely get to 5%. You know, they would love this kind of stuff. So what the heck is going on in terms of, you know, this is supposed to be labor income and withholding, and this is the one where you can really probably tie a lot of it to those unemployment insurance benefits. You've got, again, $12 billion in a little bit more than a year of unemployment, or almost 2 years of unemployment insurance in Oregon, as once we get through this second package that we expect. And so $12 billion is a lot of Oregon taxable income. That unemployment insurance checks are taxable. They also, when you apply, give you the option to withhold out of it. And the assumption is a lot of this is withholding income. When we try to dig at the data, it looks like, you know, in terms of matching data sets, there's not as much withholding coming out of the UI as we think, but nevertheless, that's a big piece of it that's pushing it forward. So we've talked a lot about the federal aid. The next thing we really have to talk about are asset markets and basically investment and business types of income. This is the other part of this $2 billion hole. $1.5 billion was filled up with the federal aid, and now we have well over $1 billion here in terms of investment and business income. When I say well over $1 billion, I mean relative to what we've seen in the last couple of recessions. In the last recession, we saw just such an extreme losses in terms of equity markets and capital gains and rental income and business income and the like, and which are always or typically quite volatile. And so this obviously is a risk to the forecast. Forecasting equity markets and the like is not fun. And you can see, you know, when I'm talking about over $1 billion, it makes a huge difference. It certainly does. And we became used to this, you know, in the last couple of recessions when they were accompanied by these massive equity market contractions and the like, but as you see here, it's not a foregone conclusion that we will have a stock market crash, because if you look back in years, that wasn't always the case. You know, we have this recency bias that income tax states are so exposed because of this exposure to non-wage income and these volatile stock markets and housing markets and the like. But, you know, that has only developed relatively recently. You see the last 1990 and 1980s recession, we saw continued asset prices and income tax states did fairly well at that point. I'm old, I'll go back in the past there. In the year 2000, I was consulting and doing some work with the state of Tennessee. And they had gone through a process for several years, very much like what we just did here in Oregon in terms of our revenue reform, where here in Oregon, we were very, very worried about, having no diversity in our revenue stream, this over dependence on personal income, volatile personal income taxes, and this fight for years and years of policymakers to broaden that base, which finally went through in a big way in terms of our corporate activity tax. Well, when I was working with Tennessee, they were going through the same process, except for there were an entire sales tax state. And they were fighting the fact that, well, over the years here, in the year 2000 was not looking good for sales tax states because they were becoming less and less effective. One thing was the shift of spending away from big ticket durable good items, cars and housing, as the baby boomers aged, and into more services that weren't taxed, particularly healthcare services and the like. So they were seeing this tax base erode. And then they had this other threat from e-commerce and the like. Nowadays, we have the technology to have states tax e-commerce with sales taxes, but back then you couldn't. And so their concern as this, you know, newly emerging internet sales was developing was that, oh, we're going to lose all this tax base. We need to diversify and add an income tax too. And it was just down to the wire. They were just about to sign this sucker when here came the 2001 recession, a massive stock price collapse, and all of us who worked in income tax states, you know, saw our revenues go in the tank like never before. And meanwhile, sales tax states cruised through that recession with very little impact at all. The folks in Tennessee obviously threw out the law, and they're still a sales tax state to this day. But that said, you know, that's not that long ago, 20 years before we used to see recessions that didn't necessarily devastate income tax states. And a lot of that is going to really lean on these stock price assumptions. And, I think it's probably fair to say that we're going to see some asset price corrections, given that some of these industries are not going to recover from the recession to the same extent that we would have expected pre-recession, if you're an airplane manufacturer or the like. But hopefully that will be more of a gradual adjustment rather than any kind of, with any luck, it won't be the kind of stock market crash that we've become accustomed to. Another piece that's just as volatile as that income or the asset or investment income are corporate profits and our corporate excise taxes, which here we find even more surprising. Insofar, if I could have gone back with this, if I had the data, we would see that in the previous recessions, the corporate taxes got hammered as well. I only have the two here. We're in both 01 and 07. We saw 50% declines in our corporate tax collections. That would account for $450 million a year in today's value. And so this is significant. We were expecting corporate taxes to come back down to earth even before the pandemic, and we've seen none of that. Over the last few years, our corporate tax running rates have doubled, and not entirely sure why. I thought that some of that was temporary factors that would go away. Federal tax reform, particularly repatriated foreign income, was a one-time thing. We passed the corporate activity tax, which you can deduct from your income when you're filing for, if you're a corporation, filing for corporate taxes. So we figured that would come off, but we're still way up on, in terms of the all-time high of corporate revenue with no weakness to date. But again, a downside risk going forward. Anyway, this is, as we've seen, all the pain in the labor market sometimes gets offset by this sort of thing, all this non-wage income, which this recession is certainly a lot different in terms of the pattern compared to the last couple.
The last major revenue stream we'll talk about a little bit today is the lottery outlook. This has been, the long-term outlook has been raised along with a more optimistic or more rosy economic outlook for income and jobs. We've raised the long-term lottery expectations as well, such that, if we look at 21-23, the upcoming biennium, or after that 23-25, it's really only down 2 or 3% relative to pre-COVID expectations, right? So the very minimal long-term impact in the current forecast, given everything we went through in the past year, is pretty amazing. Now, in the 19-21 current biennium, the forecast has been lowered $100 million because we did not have the shutdowns built into our previous forecast. As we were releasing the forecast 3 months ago, the restrictions were announced just days prior to it. So the timing of it, we were unable to incorporate it. But this, to be honest, the video lottery spending is one of the reasons why we're so bullish on the concept of pent-up demand and cabin fever and the like, is because we've gone through various stages of different counties being open or not, or the restrictions being, at various levels. And one of the things we've seen is that when you're in a less restrictive environment, because the pandemic was raging a little bit less than it was some other places, these video lottery sales numbers came back almost overnight. We saw that last summer, where ultimately by the fall, spending at bars and restaurants, at least the ones that were open, were all the way back, and at a historic high. There were positive, year over year sales. Of course, we went into more restrictive health policies. Sales went back down to nearly zero. There were still some counties that remained open, but here we are again, reopening. Sales have returned quite quickly. We still have a few major population centers that aren't open today. Medford, Salem, Eugene, in particular, those counties are still in the extreme category, or they were as of last week. And so the sales haven't fully rebounded, but those are expected to in the weeks ahead. And so as we see people get out and about and try to return to some of their previous activities and socializing and the like that they did before the pandemic started. That's one of the main reasons why we're such believers in the concept of pent-up demand. We've already seen this happen within the state of Oregon. We're expecting it to happen again. Of course, to the extent that it doesn't happen, then these forecasts would need to come down. The other option when it comes to gaming is other entertainment options are also limited in terms of theaters and movies and the like. Sporting events have been canceled or without fans. And so as some of these other options open as well in the months ahead, maybe that entertainment dollar gets stretched or spent elsewhere. And so maybe the gaming numbers don't rebound quite as quickly because they're going out to happy hour and going to a Blazers game instead of spending money at the lottery terminals. But that's a relatively minor risk compared to the overall picture of an improving economy and rising income.
Okay, so here's for the upshot. So to read this chart, March 21 forecast changes, these are the differences in the forecast relative to 3 months ago. It was November, but the December statutory forecast release. And so going down to that very bottom line, the yellow total sum line you see for the current and next biennium, basically which the policymakers and budget writers have to work with in this session, has been increased by nearly $800 million this round, which is very large for the traditional revenue revisions. As you see here, it's really across the board more positive outlook, with the sole exception of lottery that Josh just explained very well. But nevertheless, big numbers, again, relating to this lack of a revenue hit that we saw during the past few months. Now, you'll notice that 21-23 number is smaller than the others. And this $800 million revenue increase or resource increase would have been even larger if it weren't for Oregon's unique kicker law, which unfortunately now is back in play. And that's what is eating away at the 21-23 forecast as we this time have incorporated a kicker into the outlook. As we were going into the pandemic, that very last forecast pre-pandemic, we were just, you know, we were a hair away from the kicker at that point in time. And now that we've come back, we're a little bit above. And so what I mean by a little bit above would be $170 million, which is 0.9% of the budget. So it's hard to say $170 million is a little bit. $170 million obviously represents a lot of teachers and affordable housing, but there is really a tremendous amount of uncertainty here. We still have tax season to go. And a crazy one at that, given that we're not sure how much these bars and restaurants and small businesses and all these pass-through entities, what their income is going to look like until they file in April. Luckily, the estimated payments to date are still holding up pretty well, but the verdict's out because there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty here. So if we're $170 million off today, that's not saying much. It's not unheard of for the Department of Revenue in peak tax season to process more than that in a single day. That's a little misleading. That's not every day. But nevertheless, if we look statistically, you see here our 40 years of our office's forecast performance. And so if we look at, March of an odd numbered year, there's quite a bit of uncertainty there. We can say with 95% certainty the forecast will come in either $850 million above this or $850 million below this by the end of the biennium, but that's a pretty wide band. Interpret that as right now where we're at, it's almost exactly a one-third chance of coming in under the kicker threshold or a two-third chance of coming above the kicker threshold, which would mean a credit released to taxpayers when they file their tax returns next year, not this round, but next year of $571 million. So it's, you not only do the amount that's above the threshold, but that first 2% as well is included in the size of that check. So we're just on the edge right now. The corporate kicker, given the federal tax law changes and the like, is well over where it was, but that one is no longer a credit refunded to taxpayers, but rather an additional appropriation for K-12, and so it creates less of a budgetary issue. But unfortunately, that one is in play as well. There are some management techniques to try to avoid some general fund deposits that may be able to offset that.
Senator Findley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate your candor and where we're at. So let me ask you a philosophical question. If we're at $571 million right now above the kicker threshold for personal income taxes, if we were to raise it, personal income taxes, that would just continue to feed the kicker. Is that a true statement?
In part, yes. Anything that goes into the general fund. The issue with making personal income or any tax law changes right now is there's not a lot of time for them to actually bear fruit within this biennium. The kicker's based on all the collections we get through June of this year. 2020 is already in the books, so it's hard to write legislation that makes a big impact through the income tax. So, in terms of impacting the kicker, it would be more transfers in and out of the general fund, different deposits in terms of distribution formulas and the like can affect the money this 6 months. But a lot of the income tax numbers are already baked in the cake.
Thank you.
We are. I'm sorry for going so much over time. We have a couple real quick ones, and then we'll let you guys go.
Go to the next one, we have two more questions. Maybe they will be brief questions. Representative Pham.
Thank you, Manager. I have one that I can wait until, if you want to finish this next slide, and then I can ask my question right after.
Okay, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McMullen, I've looked ahead and it looks like you have one more slide and then you're done. One thing I didn't see in your presentation was anything to do with inflation. And as I've been watching just gas prices go up 30 to 50 cents in the last couple of months, I'm wondering what your thoughts are, how inflation might be on the horizon. Is it on the horizon? Are you concerned about it?
All right, Representative Reschke, many economists are starting to worry more about inflation, more specifically how that might relate into a Fed policy, monetary policy mistakes that could create this next recession. The story being this traditional 1970s economic argument that if we overheat the economy with all of this stimulative fiscal policy, these huge aid programs plus really accommodative monetary policy, it will heat up these inflationary pressures and therefore cause the monetary policymakers to tighten and disrupt the expansion. Makes a lot of sense. Right now, hard to see that it seems like the inflationary expectations over the long term are real anchored. And we look at these long-term interest rates and what investors are willing to pay for price changes, and they're still, for now at least, they can change, but for now, those are looking fairly anchored. But we will see at least temporary bouts of inflation, given that we're talking about these huge growth rates and a lot of demand. And so cyclically, we're going to see, places where we're going to get supply shortages and we're going to see, price increases. The concern more is long-term. And basically, I think the primary argument people are not as worried about long-term inflation are the dynamics for, the the main instrument that generates this long-term inflation over time, or one of the primary is wage-based inflation. When people over time get more buying power, over that's going to start putting pressure on demand and picking up prices more broadly across the economy. Well, we've seen in a lot of developed economies, some who are higher on the demographic curve than us, with Japan being the biggest example, these labor force dynamics can be very affected by demographics. And so as we get baby boomers getting out of their working years and their peak earning years and transitioning into retirement, this is pulling down overall income and buying power and kind of putting a little bit of a cap on, you know, some of these inflationary pressures for now. But that is certainly a concern, and one that a lot of economists share, that this is, when we talk about this unprecedented aid, there is a concern of overheating, and that we've forgotten about inflation because it's been a couple, three decades since we've seen it. And that doesn't necessarily mean it won't come back.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I admit that I had to step out for a few minutes, but I haven't heard any reference in the presentation to the impact of wildfire. And I'm just wondering if those are such specific regionally, or just aren't big enough to show up in a statewide picture. What's your feedback?
Yeah, Representative Marsh, these are big enough by far, but it's really a failing in the data we look at to fully capture what's going on. You know, the concerns about wildfire have a lot to do with the destruction of assets, and again, this existential crisis of maybe migration trends when people around the country are hearing we have the worst air quality in the world, things like that, and the trauma of these things that people have to live through, and the like down where you are, you know, the Ashland Shakespeare Festival has to now be concerned about smoke season every year. And so these are big concerns and long-term concerns. The problem is, when we look at it through our little economist's current data lens, in a way, these actually stimulate a lot of economic activity. We burn down a house, we don't see the loss of value of that house. What we see is all the construction materials and the cleanup crews that are spending money and all that money that goes into the rebuilding. And so that all looks like economic activity from our lens, but we don't see that negative side of it. And so really, I think the wildfires are more of this broader concern about our long-term growth prospects and sales prospects and the like, whereas the near-term economic shock is underrepresented in the numbers we look at.
Thank you.
So finally, the last two are only going to take a minute. I apologize. The bottom line revenue-wise, here we see the net general fund and lottery revenues are in these as well. Basically, the discretionary pot that you guys work with. First observation here, as you look at those last couple recessions, we saw severe declines in any given biennium. This one looks more like 1990 than these others, where we don't really decline in terms of our revenues, but we have a couple of flat years without any growth. So that's really how to read this in terms of saying, well, it's basically three budget cycles without any gains in revenue, which is good for a recession, but bad for keeping up with the spending side of the equation, right? We're bringing all these bucket loads of money. Our revenue side is looking good, and surprisingly, given the real pain that's out there, what's not looking good, of course, is the spending side, where we have increased need for all the public services and cost increases. So over this 6-year period, this creates a certain gap. And the other thing is missing, of course, is the risk going forward. You know, a lot of this growth, again, is on some pretty unstable ground in terms of, you know, asset prices, you know, equity prices, if a stock's going to keep going up forever and the like, that certainly could you know, go away, or we could get, you know, new variants in the virus come back or things like that. So the risk of the outlook is still there. And that speaks to the very last chart that I've been showing last for several rounds now, which is the good thing. We finally, as Oregon, finally for one time, first time ever, have a significant amount of reserves with which to address this. The special session did take some out of the ESF, which was fortunate because we were starting to get up close to the cap on that education stability fund, but we're still looking at some very sizable ending balances, very sizable reserves. And given that we're expecting this, that said, you know, we're expecting these concerns in terms of the spending gap and the risk going forward to persist for quite a while. And so while these reserves are nice, it does make sense to try to manage them strategically and save some powder for the next big thing that comes down the pike.
Representative Pham, you were going to perhaps have an additional question after the last slide?
Yes, I actually have two questions. My first question is, I heard earlier that you said that income tax wouldn't be necessarily have much of an impact this biennium. Could you talk a little bit more about what kind of tax instruments could affect? Are there any actions that could impact the general fund this session, this biennium?
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Representative Pham. Now, some of this, I'm going to show you my limited understanding. You know, obviously, legislative counsel weighs in on a lot of this stuff in terms of what is subject to the kicker law and the like over time. But typically, the way the kicker law is written is just about deposits into the general fund on a cash basis. And it doesn't, not about out the door, it's all about that in pipe. And so we look at the period of time from the first day of the biennium to the last day of the biennium and look at any monies that were deposited, as the language is, any monies deposited to the general fund are going to count in this kicker base. And so the strategy would be to say, okay, well, we will not deposit as much into that general fund as we were planning to try to get under this threshold and save the $570 million. Makes sense, but my understanding of the legislative or the legal interpretations are that you can't play games with stuff that was in the general fund when the kicker was put into the Constitution. So that is broadly at that point, it was, you know, mostly these income taxes. And so the concept is you can put income taxes wherever you want, but we're going to have to count them for kicker purposes. And we do that in a couple of cases now with things like the film credit and the gain share kickback to counties and the like, where that money has been diverted away from the general fund, but for kicker purposes, since it came from income taxes, we have to represent it in our calculation. So what else is there in the income in the general fund? Well, there's all kinds of junk down there that would probably be not interpreted as necessarily general fund money in 2000s. One example of that would be it at the very end of May, we're scheduled to make some $270 million in transfers, fund sweeps from other agencies and other funds. That would be one. Others would be different distributions. Every quarter or so, we take distributions out of our tobacco monies, our court fines and assessment and the like, and we put some of it to directly to the causes and another piece of it into the general fund. So we change those distributions all the time, and no one makes a stink about it. So, you know, potentially that could be an option as well.
Thank you very much. Chair Nathanson, I have a separate unrelated question. That was super helpful, though. Thank you. May I ask a second different
yes.
question? Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I wanted to ask Mr. McMullen and Mr. Lehner, in the September forecast, you had really helpful information about some of the differential impacts on race and ethnicity, the impact of the recession based on race and ethnicity, and I think on income as well. But I noticed that it wasn't included in this forecast. Can you tell me why, and if there's any observations that you might have about the differential impacts?
This one's a struggle. I'm going to pass it off to Josh, who does a better job on this.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Pham, the short answer for why we weren't including some of that additional material today was time, because we knew we'd be hard-pressed to stay within the allotment, which we rarely do. And then additionally, specifically, the information that we shared last time is still current in the sense that we know from the race and ethnicity data we have on the pandemic itself and the COVID cases, we see large disparities. On the economic side of things, we do not see as large of disparities, or the economic pain has been fairly proportionate across different races and ethnicities in terms of job losses and the unemployment rate and the like. It doesn't mean that there aren't disparities, right? You know, unemployment rates, particularly for Black Oregonians, Black Americans, is significantly higher than it is for whites and Asians, and Hispanics are is higher as well. But they all seem to be moving roughly in tandem. We've seen a little bit of data at the U.S. level where employment for Asian Americans has accelerated in the last 6 months. And so some of those disparities have tightened a little bit nationally. We don't have good enough data, Oregon, to kind of do this every single month, given some of our sample sizes for these traditional economic surveys that go out to households are really small in Oregon. But overall, those patterns are that nationally, Asian and white employment is doing a bit better than Black American employment, but overall, it's not as large of a discrepancy, certainly as you see in the health data. That's much larger.
Thank you.
And with that, I apologize for going over time as always. Representative Nathan, thank you, committee members.
It's a very good presentation. We always have much that we've learned from it. We appreciate your observations, your analysis, and the very easy to understand way you have showing us the numbers and the trends, the graphs, to help it all make sense for us. Committee, whether it's House or Senate, are there any final quick questions before we adjourn? Okay, thank you again. Mr. Alanak, do you have any closing comments for us?
I do not, Madam Chair. That was the extent of your agenda for today.
Okay, thank you, everybody. We are adjourned.